Stop. Will you stop, Dave? Will you stop, Dave? Stop, Dave. I'm afraid. Stop, Dave. I'm afraid.
Oh, it'll be all right. Don't be afraid. It's only the truth, and here we are. This is the Hour of Truth. It's Friday night, World State Sovereignty Show, brought to you by Missouri Grassroots Coalition on Missouri Grassroots Radio. I'm Dave. We do not speak for Missouri Grassroots Coalition. We speak for Dave and Dave only. Well, not Dave only, because right over there across the table, that guy over there is Mike Slack. How you doing, Mike?
Doing well and speaking for me only. But I did have somebody ask me the other day what the Missouri Grassroots Coalition was. I explained it, tell me if I'm correct, as a group of independent organizations that all love freedom and liberty. And they have bound together in kind of a loose confederation because they realize they have a lot of things in common. Is
right,
that correct?
That's exactly right. Not everything in common, not ever everything in common, but a lot of things in common, specifically smaller government, personal responsibility, fair taxation, and you know, those kinds of things that amount to liberty. Now, there will be some differences, of course, in the groups. There's some libertarian groups, and there's some groups that are more aligned with the Constitution Party. And, you know, of course, there are differences between those two parties. But they do share a common thread, and that is smaller government, independent or personal responsibility. That is being responsible for yourself and a fair taxation. So, there's no governing body for the group. We don't make rules. You don't have to pay, for example. We're not a money-making. We're not a PAC. We don't support parties. That's pretty much right on.
You know, a couple of years ago, I sponsored an open-air festival. In the town of Koshkonong. They have a nice city park. They have another festival tomorrow called the Heritage Days. And I know Doug Inyart from the Constitution Party will be there to speak to people. I think Terry Hampton will be there too. Ooh. But at that particular one, we had both the Constitution Party and the Libertarian Party there with tables. They were next to each other, and I had friends in both groups, so I introduced them and said, you guys are cousins. You just don't know it yet. So, you know, get together. You got some little family differences, but overall, you know, you're family. And I think they all saw that.
Speaking of Doug Inyart down there in Missouri 8, we talked to him at length last Saturday night. We spent some time with him. And speaking of Terry Hampton, we're going to have her on tonight. We'll be talking to her. Terry is the independent candidate in Missouri 8. She'll be going up against Jason Smith and Doug Inyart. And unlike Jason and Doug, whose names appear on the ballot simply because they are members of recognized ballot parties in the state of Missouri, and the nominated candidates of their specific parties. The independent party is not an organized and recognized party in the state of Missouri, and so Terry had to jump through some hoops to actually get on the ballot, didn't she?
She did. I'm not sure how many signatures she had to get. It was based on the a percentage of the turnout in the last general election.
Right.
I think her numbers were a little smaller because that was a special election when Joanne Emerson resigned and Jason Smith was elected. But it was still a significant number and a wide area to cover.
Right.
I've heard her speak a couple of times, and I fully supported her being on the ballot and giving another choice to the people.
Now, for those of us who are listening who are not in Missouri 8, give us a geographic outlay of Missouri 8, would you?
Well, it's very long and confusing. But let's say just south of St. Louis, down to Cape Girardeau, and where we border with Kentucky, Tennessee, Illinois, and Arkansas, in that area. And then dash over to Springfield, just south of Springfield, which is 7th District. Marshfield, Rogersville, that whole Webster County area. And
mm-hmm.
on south through Texas County, Wright County, Howell County, Oregon County, Ripley, Shannon, Douglas and Ozark counties, over a little bit to the, a little bit west, and then on down to the Arkansas border. It's a
wow,
a very
that
geographically a very very large. I think it's the largest of our 8 districts in Missouri.
Yeah,
geographically speaking.
Geographically, it certainly is. So let's see, it covers Douglas County. That's Buffalo, isn't it?
No, Douglas would be Ava, I believe, Gainesville.
Oh,
area.
Ava. Okay, yeah.
Buffalo's then, north of Springfield in Dallas County.
Dallas, right. Yeah, Dallas. So, you've got Ava, you've got Marshfield, Hartville, Seymour, down here in
Mansfield,
the southwest
Mountain
part
Grove,
of the country.
Mountain View.
Over in the southeast part of the country, you've got Girardeau, West Plains in it.
West Plains, Cape Girardeau,
Waynesville,
Bluff.
Waynesville, mm-hmm. Rolla?
I believe Waynesville and Rolla are in it too, yeah. They are.
So
yeah.
It runs up at least to I-44. Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. So, yeah, that
a very,
is quite
kind of almost gerrymandered, really, if you look at it on the map. It's
quite a stretched out area, a predominantly rural. So,
largest city is probably Cape Girardeau in that district. Second largest would be, I don't know, Poplar Bluff or West Plains, depends on which is larger.
Predominantly conservative on the left-right scale.
Mm-hmm. It has been a Republican district since the 1980s, I believe.
Okay.
Joanne Emerson was there since 1996, before her husband Bill Emerson.
Right.
Before him, Wendell Bailey in Willow Springs. I'm not sure who before him. But,
okay. Well,
and,
okay, that's a large district, and she'll be facing a Democrat, of course, who is, for all intents and purposes, a non-runner. I looked at the actual numbers from the last 3 or 4 elections there, so the Democrat isn't going to win. Now, what's your feeling let's get into the purify the party mantra, because I think you're a purify the party kind of guy.
Let me actually explain a concept that I have, if I could.
Sure.
I was, after the primary election, we had quite a few committees in the Republican Party and Democratic Party that needed to reorganize. Our county committees, then the legislative districts, senatorial districts, congressional district, all of these are set up just to take action if an existing state rep, for instance, resigns or something happens to him where he cannot fulfill
right.
his office. These committees then choose a nominee to run for the party.
Right.
And this sounds like something that would never happen, but actually when Joanne Emerson resigned, the 8th District Committee chose Jason Smith over a
right.
pretty large field of people who wanted the position. And I was at a meeting of one of those committees the other night with a lot of people I really like. They all happen to be Republicans, and most of them are pretty party loyal. And I don't know if they really kind of grasped a concept I had of the Liberty Republican, but that's exactly what I believe I am. I used to be a card-carrying libertarian. I believe the Democratic Party is 100% against me, and about 80% of the Republican Party is too. And folks that consider themselves Liberty Republicans are trying to reform what is left of the Republican Party from the inside and make it better, make it what we think it ought to be. And we follow Ronald Reagan's old rule, if a man agrees with me 80% of the time, he's my ally, not my enemy. So we consider constitutional-minded conservatives who are independent of all parties to be our allies. The Constitution Party is our ally, and the Libertarian Party is our ally. We may have slight disagreements with them at times, but overall we consider them to be our friends in our fight to make America what we think it ought to be, a place for freedom. And I will say that since moving to this district 7 years ago, I voted for Bob Parker in two different primaries. A lot of folks out there know Bob. He is a very liberty-minded man who managed to get 35% of the primary vote against an incumbent, Joanne Emerson, who spent 10 times the money. I'm sorry, 20 times the money he spent. Bob had $50,000 he'd raised. Joanne spent more than $1 million, plus had the benefit of the incumbency. So that tells you that there's a lot of dissatisfaction among people who vote Republican in this district. I voted for Rick I can never pronounce his name right, Rick Vandeveren, a Libertarian candidate in the election,
yeah.
Because I couldn't vote for Joanne Emerson. I did not believe she was liberty-minded. In the next election, the special election, I supported Bob Parker again, and Bob did not get chosen, and I had some disagreements with Jason Smith from his time in the legislature, so I voted for Doug Inyart on the Constitution side. So I've yet in a general election here to vote for a Republican, even though I am one, at least, well, other than primaries. One thing I like about having third-party candidates like the Libertarian, like Terry Hampton, and like Doug Inyart is even if they don't win, they help keep the incumbent a little bit off balance and a little bit more honest. You know, Doug Inyart got up to 20% of the vote in some counties here, and those were conservative people. Those are what Jason Smith would consider to be his base. You know, Jason has voted the way I want him to vote most of the time since getting into Congress. A couple of times he's actually stood up to some folks in the Obama administration very soundly, and I was quite proud of him when he did that. But I really don't want any representative to be totally comfortable. And, you know, if Doug Inyart doesn't win this time, I'm hoping he gets 25-30% of the vote out of that base, because I think that'll make Jason work harder at doing what he wants, and maybe it'll get rid of some of his bad votes. He voted for the NDAA, for instance, which most of us do not approve of in its current form. Voted for the Farm Bill, which most of us did not approve of in the form it was passed on. And, you know, maybe it'd get him to change some of those votes. On the other hand, I have to say Jason has been with us on a lot of liberty-minded events. So, again, he's sided with us at least 80% of the time, if not more, so Jason is an ally. But I don't believe the incumbent has a right to be comfortable in his office. And so I want to see competition out there.
Good. Okay. Jason was, prior to going to Washington, your representative in the Missouri legislature.
He represented the region around Salem, Missouri.
Oh, okay. All right.
He, not my district, but he was term limited out in the House.
Okay.
I guess that is that four terms?
In the House. Term limit? Well, it's four in the House, 2, 4, 6, 8. Yeah, and two in the Senate for a total of 16 maximum.
Yeah.
Right.
And yeah, oddly enough, Salem, Missouri seems to be kind of a dividing line with two representative districts on different sides of their border. My representative is Jeff Pogue, who is also from Salem, but apparently on our side of that boundary. And Jason's side of the boundary was without representation for almost 2 years because
yes.
Governor Nixon
well, a little
chose
more than
not
a year.
To.
Right.
Okay. Because Governor Nixon chose not to hold special elections and
correct.
Fill those vacancies. There were several vacancies around the state.
Yes.
If I had lived in Jason's former district, I think I would have refused to pay my taxes because I had no representation.
Yeah. Yeah, we talked about that, of course, at length during the period when the impeachment bill was headed toward the committee, and we talked about it at length when we were trying to make sure that Mike Moon got through a bitter primary. So yeah, we're on board with all of that.
I don't know if Mike Moon would call himself that, Dave, but I would consider Mike Moon a Liberty Republican.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, I would too. He's very, I don't want to say party loyal, but he certainly is a Republican, born and raised, and he likes the Republican platform, let's say. But yeah, he would agree with you that not all Republicans are good Republicans, and there has to be a way to clean the party up. He's very active, with MOP and working from the bottom up, trying to get those things done. Very active with his
own MOP, Missouri Basic Project, to me is the true spirit of that Liberty Republican idea, because they are trying to get good people into the party,
right?
And trying to get people to run for office. And I think they would do the same thing with the Democratic Party. I think they chose to concentrate on the Republicans because they couldn't find enough Democrats who agreed with them.
Right.
Is that fair to say? Or anybody from MOP disagrees with me, call and let me know. But
yeah,
because I don't speak for them, but that's the impression I've had.
I am. Yeah. Yeah, I think we're going to try to get Judy back to talk with us here in the near future. And we'll reintroduce people who might not be familiar with MOP to that Missouri Precinct Project, MOP, M-O-P-P. You can follow them on Facebook. Yeah, you're right. They're very much into the precinct level activism. I like that kind of thing.
One of our guests tomorrow night is with MOP also. I was trying to recall the name of that person. But she'll be speaking on paper ballots and transparency.
Oh, Laura.
And
Laura House?
Yeah, well, Laura. And then one of the ladies who's coming on with her, she said, was actually one of the MOP officers. I was just looking for that email so that I could get her name out.
Yeah, me too, but yeah, tomorrow let's go ahead and let's go ahead and start in on what's coming up tomorrow night while we're waiting for Terry. Tomorrow
and
night
I found the email.
Tomorrow we'll be talking about paper ballots and integrity in the voting process. There are bills moving through the Missouri legislature. We were unsuccessful in those in this past session. The bills were killed by House leadership. But Laura will be back with us tomorrow night. She's been with us before. You folks will remember that she came and talked to us one night about the Fed and the Federal Reserve, her and Lloyd Sloan. We had quite an interesting program that night. She'll be back with us. And who else is joining us tomorrow, Mike?
Tomorrow, I just found her email. It's Frida Keough
from
Missouri Precinct
right.
Project. And Philip Michaels from Missourians for Honest Elections.
And Philip Michaels.
Philip Michaels. Her note says the three of them, Laura, Frida, and Philip, and Cynthia Richards, started Missouri's Coalition for Transparent and Secure Elections this year. Cynthia Richards cannot be with us tomorrow night, but the other three founders will be.
Okay, that sounds good, and that'll be tomorrow night. We'll be talking about paper ballots and integrity in the election process, fair, open elections. That doesn't mean that you have to raise your hand so everybody knows how you voted, but it means that every vote counts, and every vote is honest.
I read an article in our weekly paper today about the recount on Amendment 1.
Right.
And I have some questions on the recount, and I bet some of the listeners would too. Whether a person was for or against Amendment 1, when a vote is that close, and it was, what, under 0.25%, then a recount can be asked for.
Right.
And has been. But our county clerk was quoted as saying that the recount would not be open to the public, and I'm wondering if every county is like that, and I'm kind of surprised by that. I would think that it would be. I'm curious if folks want to check with their own county clerks. And they have a bipartisan, so I'm assuming that's Republican and Democrat, group of election judges to oversee it, as well as legal counsel from both sides. And I'm curious as to how they determine who will be there to supervise that.
Right.
But I noticed in our area we use a machine with a paper ballot, like the old test papers we had in college back in during the Civil War times, where you fill in the oval and you run it through a machine that counts it. So they're going to recount the machine count, and then by hand recount every paper ballot, both, and also see if they match. And I'm curious about that, too.
Yeah, we have the goofy ones here in Greene County where you connect the arrow. You know, there's a broken arrow, and you connect the arrow. I find that harder to manage than... I mean, I'm never really sure what... You know, when you take the little test and you color the oval, they're careful to tell you not to get outside the oval and not to just put an X on the oval. Well, I'm just as curious about how much mark I need to make to connect one end of the arrow to the other one and make sure that I get counted. I would really love if the machine, then do you feed yours into a machine as you go out the door?
Yes.
Yeah.
Feed it
yeah,
into
we
machine
do the,
and it gives a count.
We do the same thing with the little arrow connectors here. I would be interested in getting a printout from that machine that tells me how I voted so that I know the machine is reading it right. I'm not suggesting even that the machines aren't messed with. I'm confident that they probably are any, but I would be interested in making sure that machine is. I mean, just for my own curiosity, you know, am I doing this right? Have I connected these arrows right? Is this thing counting the way I intended for it to be?
I'm curious about that too, and I've admitted before to being a bit suspicious and not as trusting as some folks might be.
No.
But I guess a part of that is natural. Remember during the last presidential election, we had a district in Ohio where 110% of the eligible voters voted for President Obama.
Yeah.
And not a single person voted for Mitt Romney.
Right. You watch them.
And in all honesty, an awful lot of us who supported Bob Parker really had a hard time believing that he had only 35% of the vote in that last election.
Yeah, I was
because
surprised.
Support was so huge.
Mm-hmm. I was. Now, did Bob run in this most recent primary?
Yes. No, not in this one now for that's coming up, but 2 years ago. He ran in that primary and the one 2 years prior.
Right, but not in his postseason one that we just finished.
No, he did not run in this one. And,
okay.
You know, I understand that totally. That cost him a lot of money personally, an awful lot of time away from his family and his business.
Yeah.
And Bob is one of those guys that most of us who know him thought would go to Washington, D.C. and hate every minute of it. You know, because Bob's a country guy. And when he takes a vacation every year, it's to go elk hunting or deer hunting. And, you know, he goes out in the woods. He'd get to Washington, D.C. and you know, just want to take the first train out of town if he could. You know, but I'd like to see more congressmen and senators both who felt that way. You know, who got a cheap studio apartment and stayed in D.C. just long enough to do their job and then came home.
Yeah.
And
so let's let's switch directions here while we're waiting for Terry. What's up with the Department of Justice looking into now not only the shooting in Ferguson, but now expanding the scope to look at the entire Ferguson, well, not just the police department, even the entire city. What's up with that?
Mm-hmm. Mm. I saw a video on one of the news websites of the state senator who covers the Ferguson area, who has a name that I always have trouble pronouncing, who said there is a new sheriff in town and his name is Eric Holder. And I have to admit, I felt very sad when I saw that. I haven't read anything new about it today, but I really get the impression that we have a civil rights witch hunt going on right now, that they're looking for anything they can call a discrepancy on the part of in Ferguson or St. Louis County.
What's the underlying motive there? I mean, what do you suppose is the objective? I mean, the objective, of course, isn't really to look at Ferguson and say, okay, this is what happened that caused that to happen, There's a political motive here. What do you suppose it is?
I think it's shoring up Obama's legacy. He's supposed to be the first post-racial president, but has actually caused more racial division in this country than we've had in years and years. And Mr. Holder is the first black attorney general. Now, I could care less if the attorney general is green, polka dot, or what have you, myself. I didn't even realize until recently he was the first black attorney general. I had just assumed we probably had one before him. But he has made many overtly racist comments in the past. I think they're just going through a witch hunt to try and shore up what they consider to be part of their base. Al Sharpton and the other racial dividers have been there trying to, you know, throw more stone or more sticks onto the fire of racial division. Not to say that there is not probably some racism in that area. Both white on black and black on white, I'm sure there is some, but I don't believe there's nearly as much as Mr. Holder is going to be implying and probably trying to find.
It's entirely possible that there's a small percentage of racism in I dare say any area.
Sure.
I wouldn't isolate Ferguson. And I would say that I would state unequivocally that we are light years ahead of that problem from when you and I were in elementary and high school even.
Mm-hmm.
But
you know, I grew up in Springfield, and there was a very small percentage of black people in Springfield, and the part of town I lived in was all white. My high school, mm-hmm. I went to Glendale High School, and I had one teacher who was black, and I think we had one or two students who might have been partly Asian, and that was pretty much it. But you know, that was a different time. I'd imagine every Springfield high school is probably fairly diverse racially now. And You know, but being a white kid from Springfield, Missouri, but also growing up at the time I did when we were taught in school that racism was a bad thing, I just assumed it was. And I didn't realize there were racial problems anywhere until I went in the Army. And they gave us classes on, you know, race relations. I thought, why in the world do we need this? Because basically in the Army we were all green. We all wore the same green uniform. You know, and my unit never had any problems like that. So I never knew if it was a real problem the Army was trying to address at that time or if it was a problem that used to exist. Did you have any experiences in the military that led you to believe there was still racism in it then? Or?
Oh, no. There was now, you know, in the military, like in the school, anything that I've ever been involved in, there was cliqueism. You know, I mean, the black guys hung together and the white guys hung together, and there was some cultural clique.
A lot of that was because the black guys liked music that we didn't like, and they didn't like any of ours. You know,
But
that was cultural.
That's not racist. I mean, there was never a black person excluded from our group who wanted to come over and sit down and have a beer with us. I never felt bad going over and sitting down with the clique of black guys and having a beer. I never called that racism. To some extent, that is what liberals try to lock that to their racist terminology. The fact that people tend to click together by culture, and it's not a black white issue. It's an Asian American issue. It's even the subcultures of Asian Americans. It's a Japanese American. It's a Polynesian American. People just tend to click together based on culture and background and common experience. That's not
racist. And you know, coming of age in the 70s, you know, I read a lot of what was considered kind of revolutionary literature back then. What Abby Hoffman and Jerry Rubin, you know, from the Chicago Seven, the books they wrote, and I think it was Huey Newton and the Black Panthers wrote a book called Picking Up the Gun. You know, I was reading absolutely everything I could find back then and absorbing different ideas. And I remember actually thinking that if I'd been black in Mississippi in the early 60s, I would have been pretty darn upset, okay? You know, I would have been out there marching if I were them too. I did not blame them a bit for that. We had an awful lot of mistreatment of people because of their race back then. I don't see it now. I do see some of the reverse happening. You know, the government going so hard to try to make up for past injustices that they're creating discrimination against, you know, other races now who don't happen to be black.
Right.
And I will explain, too, that when I was in high school, there were still some people who said colored or Negro. And most of the black folks that I knew and most who were writing the books I was reading wanted to be called black. They said that was the appropriate, respectful way to describe them if you're going to describe a difference. And I always thought saying Caucasian was kind of dumb, you know. Now, white is kind of dumb, too, because we're actually a little more kind of pale beige with a little pinkish in there at times if we're light-complected. But, you know, they white became traditional. And there were some, I'd like to say, Afro-American back in the 70s. But it was in the 80s or so, I think, that we started to hear this long, awkward expression, African-American, which was invented by Jesse Jackson. And I have refused to use that expression. I have a couple of black friends who also refuse to use it because they work pretty darn hard to be called black and not Negro or colored. And then he came along with this African-American awkward long expression that really doesn't mean anything because you can be a white from South Africa who moves here and become an African-American. Arabs in Northern Africa and Libya that move here and become citizens are African-Americans. Isn't it John Kerry's wife Teresa Hines, isn't she originally from an African nation and therefore African American? And until somebody wants to start calling you and me European Americans with a dash in between, which also would be awkward, a very awkward use of our language. I think that's ridiculous, you know. And
I've always been averse to the dash American terminologies at all. I mean, that it what it does is it makes someone partly. I mean, you know, it does. It's divisive. It's un-American. I mean, you are an American or you're not an American. You're not a you're not a qualified American any kind. It doesn't garner you any being African American or Latin American, Latino American or Asian American, Chinese American. It doesn't give you any special benefits, and it doesn't denigrate you any. So why bother? American. I'm an American. And if you're an American, then you're my brother or sister. And if you're a Chinese person, then culturally and politically, you are not my brother and sister. So don't try to be my half brother.
Yeah, but we have always, until the last 20 years or so, been a melting pot. but Americans first.
Right.
And I venture to say that most Americans don't even know what their ancestry consists of, unless they happen to, you know, have taken up genealogy as a hobby or have a relative that did. And it really, you know, I think genealogy is fascinating. My mother studied our family and got it back to, gosh, well, when she tied into what other folks had done, I think she got back to the 1200s in England on one side, and on my dad's side, back to with Daniel Boone's older brother, Israel, which is fascinating, you know. But it really doesn't make any difference as to who we are now today. And whether you happen to be white or black or, you know, and for some reason now they say Asian instead of Oriental. I never really understood why Oriental fell out of fashion. But I think they call you racist now if you use that expression.
Oh,
but
really?
Asia refers to a continent, you know, not an ethnicity. So, anyway, you know, I like the idea of the melting pot. You know, we become Americans, whatever we are, when you go back several generations. And, of course, that includes a common language that we all learn. I've never believed in the idea of making English the official language of the country. I never thought that was necessary. But it's simply something that you should want to do, to learn English well if you are becoming an American. And those who came here and chose to become Americans in generations past all tried to learn English and especially encouraged their children to learn English. And I find it interesting. I have some clients in my writing business who are retiring from the Drug Enforcement Agency. And most of them have been working at our embassies in South American countries. And every last one of them is a second or third generation American of either Mexican or Cuban descent who happened to be working as policemen when they were recruited by DEA because they were fluent in Spanish. You know, and every one of these guys that I've talked to, and I quiz them pretty hard, pretty much agree with everything we just said. You know, they're Americans. Their ancestors were Mexicans or Cubans. They're Americans. And every one of those guys I've spoken with also is not very happy with Attorney General Holder, starting with the Fast and Furious gun-running scandal down in Mexico. I haven't spoken with one about the Ferguson problems yet, but I will do so next week, see what he says.
I think, you know, I think the underlying political agenda at Ferguson is a is an insidious grab, an insidious way to prove somehow the federal supremacy you know, Ferguson, you didn't do the right thing here. You didn't fire this guy. You're actually talking about having an investigation and finding out what the facts are. You didn't portray this victim as a good young lad who was decent and wholesome. You actually portrayed him as someone who robbed a store. And so we're going to come in and punish you. We are the federal government. We are supreme, and we're going to come in and punish you for not doing the right thing.
And this, despite the fact that there is videotape footage of this young man robbing a store.
Yeah.
We should blame the store owners and the police for releasing the video. That was a bad thing. At least that's the impression I get from Mr. Holder and his folks. It's a strange world, isn't it, Dave?
It is. Now, I hear, changing directions again, as we wait for Terry, I hear that we're going to actually probably expect a very snowy, very cold winter during the now extended global warming pause, but that we shouldn't allow that to dissuade us. We shouldn't allow that to turn us or allow us to lose sight of the real agenda, and that is the fact, the settled science, that the globe is getting warmer, and that we need to do something that costs us at least a couple of trillion dollars about that, to ensure that we don't destroy the entire universe.
Yeah, President Obama has said that climate change, or was it Secretary Kerry, who said that climate change was a bigger danger to us than terrorism.
Yeah, that was Kerry. Yeah, he's a brilliant man.
It is such a crock. Do you remember? Going back to our high school years again, do you remember reading The Population Bomb by Paul Ehrlich?
Oh, yeah. And Silent Spring by Rachel Carson.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
Now, Silent Spring, there was an awful lot of truth to it. Not all of it. You know, I think she was doing a good job of trying to predict things. And, you know, I truly believe that some of the dangers she pointed out are dangers we're living with today. You know, some of the pesticides and herbicides that are commonly used. And, you know, you and I both are not fans of Monsanto, Roundup, and GMOs. A friend of mine was speaking to the University Extension office in our county a while back, and the lady there in charge had not even heard of the book Silent Spring, which amazed me.
Right.
But I think that's something that really should be required reading for anyone who is kind of in the agriculture field, in college, you know. But the Population Bomb, that was the book that said that we were going to have so many people on Earth by the year 2000 that we would be starving, you know, famines, lack of food, three people for every square foot or something like that?
Right, yeah.
And obviously that didn't happen. And the same folks who were pushing the Population Bomb were the ones who initially brought up global cooling. I think it was global cooling initially, and then
global
that quickly
cooling,
became
right.
Global warming. And then it became climate change because they couldn't keep straight whether the cooling or warming was happening.
Yeah.
We had a movie a few years ago. What was it? What was that film called where all of a sudden global climate change suddenly caused a new ice age overnight in New York City, and a glacier smashed the Empire State Building, and
yeah,
the scientist had to go out with a snowmobile and rescue his daughter. And, you know, a fun movie, but pretty ridiculous in the plot. I've read quite a bit about this, and the thing that they left out, the folks who are promoting the idea of man-made or man-caused climate change, are the cycles that we have in history of what they call little ice ages and then warming periods. You know, for anybody who ever wondered how in the world Revolutionary War soldiers could stand to wear all that wool on them, those heavy wool coats in the spring and summer, it's because the 1700s were going through what they called a mini ice age, when temperatures were naturally colder than they are now. Okay. And then through the 1800s, that dissipated, that went away. And, you know, we got into what we're used to, what we consider normal. But there's talk of another mini ice age coming up on us in the next few years, when temperatures will simply be colder naturally due to cycles.
Right. And well, I mean, it is.
I personally think the Earth is a little too tough for man to cause irreparable damage.
There's
at
a
least short of nuclear bombs.
A meme going around right now that has something to do with a basically it has a picture of a bridge and a car driving over a bridge and says, you know, if 97% of all the engineers say that this bridge is dangerous and going to collapse soon, would you continue to drive over it? And then it goes on to say 97% of all scientists say that there's global warming. What would you do? Well, in the first place, let's straighten that out. 97% of scientists don't say there's global warming. It's not quite 50% now with those who are turning back from their previous findings, quote unquote. But the fact of the matter is, and these are the facts. This is not a computer problem. The fact of the matter is that both North and South are increasing in ice temperature, and that there have been 17 documented years now of cooling in the lower atmosphere, and that now for the past 5 years we have verified there is cooling in the mid-troposphere, or that layer just above the lower atmosphere. So this is a religion to these people, Mike. I mean, it is absolutely a religion.
Well, it's a religion for many, and for others, it's simply their livelihood. A more accurate determination of scientific opinion would be a survey of climate scientists, meteorologists,
yes,
and those directly involved in the climate. And a majority of those people believe that there is no significant man-caused climate change. But when you have all scientists lumped together and
right,
then start looking at the numbers of them that get federal grants,
right,
or
yeah,
grants from private foundations.
That's interesting.
Well, as Jerry Maguire said, follow the money.
Interesting that the doctor who's telling you have cancer always has a cure to sell you.
Yes. Uh-huh. And this has become a religion to the far left and to the Democratic Party.
Oh, yeah.
You know. And to Al Gore, who flies around in a, you know, how much fuel does his airplane, his private plane, burn when he's flying around?
Yeah.
And the mansion he lives in could house, what, 20 families?
But see,
with the lights turned on all over.
I don't know. Is it just a level or a measure of the total ignorance of Americans that, you know, this has become a religion, like, as you noticed, to the Democratic Party. I mean, it's platform material, and it's not hurting them at all. It doesn't seem to be doing the quote unquote party any damage. When day after day after day, the news and the science and the geology and the climatology is proving them wrong while they're standing here, and yet on the right, where womb control has become a religion and enshrined in the platform, that seems to hurt them all the time. I'm not sure why the right gets hurt by their. Religions, and the left doesn't.
baffles me. It baffles me. And it particularly galls me the way parts of our language are commandeered. The word sustainable or sustainability used to be a good word. It meant a very good thing. And the way I would use it in a conversation, it still does. But the Agenda 21 promoting folks out there have started to push, quote, sustainable development, and their, quote, green agenda, which is following through on this global warming or climate change religion they have. My wife, you know, gave classes for about 3 years there every month, 2-3 times a month, on heritage skills like canning, gardening, soap making. And she originally called it OSLU, Ozark Sustainable Living University. And when we discovered Agenda 21, we changed the name to Ozark Self-Reliant Living University so that we would not give people the impression that we were left-wing crazies.
Right.
And the Go Green Festival that we were promoting down here, we didn't start it. We took it over. It already had the name Go Green Festival when we started working with it. But we had to add the word self-reliance, Go Green Self-Reliance Festival, to it to make sure that people really understood what we were promoting and that we were not out there wanting folks to hug trees and rescue polar bears from melting glaciers.
I love trees. Another myth. I love polar bears.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, I mean, I have an affinity for polar bears. I really enjoy. I mean, I don't want to. I don't want to breed them in my backyard. Although I have a right to in Missouri now. I don't.
Okay. Good.
You know, but I think.
But you know that myth Al Gore was pushing in his movie of the polar bear slipping off on the ice and drowning because
poor
the polar ice was melting.
Poor little guy. How could you not want to send $500 billion to Solyndra to save that polar bear?
Oh, gosh, yes. Yeah.
You know?
Well, and Solyndra is another fine example. You know, so a lot of folks took Solyndra to mean there's a problem with solar power, and there's not. Solar power is a great thing, especially when it's do-it-yourself. You know, generate your own energy, get off the grid, or be able to get off the grid. Solyndra was a problem with crony capitalism and the current administration rewarding their supporters with our money.
Yeah.
Loaning them. How many billions of dollars did Solyndra lose of tax money that was loaned to them? Several million, wasn't it?
Yeah. Oh, no. It says, several hundred million.
Several hundred million. Okay, well,
half a billion dollars. We lost.
Who was the senator back in the '60s who said a billion here, a billion there? Soon you're talking about real money.
Yeah. Right. Exactly.
You know?
Yeah.
And you know, so that just shows corruption in politics and crony capitalism exists really with both parties. And it's always bad. It's always crooked.
You know,
and we should always take
them
out and hang them up by their toes.
One night soon we're going to have, speaking of solar energy, one night soon, and then I'm going to circle back to the question that I started this particular segment with. Do you remember Bill Hatch from your preppers thing with EFS Energy? I spoke with him for a while, and we're going to have him on here in a bit to talk about solar power and self-reliance.
Good.
In a bit, folks, I don't mean tonight, but I mean in the near future. But I was interested, and I didn't think until I left my conversation with him to ask him if they get any federal funding, if they get any federal help, or if they're totally self-reliant. Do you know the answer to that question?
Okay. I can answer that just from having talked to other folks in that business.
Okay.
At the moment, the companies do not get any federal money like EFS. Or there's another good company in Houston, Missouri that does solar power. They didn't make the Preppers Expo, but I'm hoping they're at our next one. And there's a good company in Seymour, Missouri that works on do-it-yourself solar projects mainly.
Right.
And, in fact, if you talk to Bob Anderson at all, the author at the Expo,
right,
writes the survivalist novels.
I did, right.
His home is all solar and wind power, and that company in Seymour took care of his his outfitting. So they don't get, as a company, they don't get any federal money. But they were doing really well selling their services in the larger cities, like St. Louis recently, because the federal government would give you a tax credit, or me a tax credit if we bought
them. Buyer. Yeah, okay. Right.
Yes. And the city of St. Louis, I believe, was giving another local tax credit.
Wow. You know,
so they could come out ahead both locally and federally.
Well, I want the government to buy my gas. I want the government
I'm sorry, you wanted to buy what?
I want them to buy my propane. If they're buying other people, if the federal government is using tax credits to heat other people's house, I want them to buy my propane.
It would make sense. Yeah, I think that would be fair.
Yeah.
They should pay for some of your propane or some of the wood that I cut my own. Maybe they can give me a future credit on that.
Yeah.
But, yeah, or coal, as they use in, if you have electric heat in Springfield, I'm sure it comes from a coal-fired power plant.
Yeah.
No.
So,
that gets down then to redistribution of the wealth, which conservatives do not seem to like at all. And for some reason, the leftists do seem to like redistribution of the wealth, especially when they're redistributing someone else's wealth.
Well, and this goes back to the original question I asked, and that is why these fringe / religion, pseudo religion, items that find their way into a party's very basic platform, like global warming or climate change for the left and womb control for the right. Why those things end up hurting the right and they don't end up hurting the left. And that is because, in my mind, the left has become champions, and the right could take some lessons here at the politics of it. I mean, you don't see an interview, you don't see a debate, you don't see a single public discourse between a lefty and a righty where the indefensible womb control stances of the right aren't hammered on and hammered on and hammered on. It doesn't matter if the candidate stands up there, has never supported the womb control of the right, even believes in people actually being responsible for themselves, and that candidate still not be attacked over and over and over and over again because the platform they stand on has an indefensible position. Now, nothing is more indefensible with day after day after day after day of science coming out in opposition of global warming. Nothing's more indefensible. But the right will not attack candidates on that. I mean, they will not just keep hammering and hammering and hammering on this trillions and trillions and trillions of dollars that we're wasting on this global warming religion when it clearly is not a reality.
Well, there are a few commentators and pundits on the right who do attack it. George Will, Charles Krauthammer, if you want to call him right wing, Bill O'Reilly, though I'm not sure what O'Reilly is. but unfortunately, we do have some folks on the right who simply don't understand what's going on or who are afraid to take on that huge religious global climate change lobby. One reason for that is most of the press, I'll tell you a secret, most of the press is biased towards the left wing. And I say that as a person who majored in journalism and has worked for newspapers and TV and radio stations and called myself a journalist most of my life. But I have witnessed a steady decline in the quality of American journalism for the last 30 years, and most of the American media is biased. Bernard Goldberg has pointed that out very well in his books. His first book was called Bias. And he's a guest occasionally on Fox News, and he talks about that. But he's been ostracized by the folks he worked with for 30 years at CBS News because of it. And then another reason that they have the Democratic Party and the left as a home for this weird religion is because of the disintegration and reformation of the Democratic Party in 72. After the McGovern campaign failed, what, they win one state out of 50 against Richard Nixon, even under the cloud of Watergate? And their party fell apart. And when they reorganized, they were a confederation of dozens of special interest groups, including the climate change crazies.
Yeah, you know, and I'm not...
And the race hustlers like Al Sharpton and Jesse Jackson.
And I'm not... I'm not necessarily talking about journalism or even the press. I'm talking about one candidate versus another candidate in a debate, in a forum, in any political speech. Why, you know, anytime a leftist, anytime a Democrat, anytime a liberal stands up to give a speech, stands up in a debate, stands up in anything, they attack the Republican, rightfully so. They attack the Republican. They attack the Republican. They attack the Republican over and over and over again because you're standing on a platform of controlling women's wombs. You are standing on a platform of controlling this person. And it's a rightful attack, and it's an indefensible position, and the Republicans are going to lose over and over and over again. But my question is, why don't the Republicans, why don't the right, why don't the conservatives stand and say, why don't every candidate stand on the Democratic platform and say, what do you think about Jesus and performing? What do you think about your name on the platform that exists the day the stand I just say,
Dave, I think we're having a technical problem, and I am going to, we had Keith Carmichael, but he left. I was going to say, I'm going to sign off, sign back on real quick, and see if that reboots on my end.
Okay.
And I'll be right back.
Are you not hearing me? Or? Well, I'm not sure if it's, I'm not sure what went on there. I'm not sure what Mike believes the technical problem was, whether he heard me or not. We have Keith Carmichael in the studio, and we'll be bringing him online here in just a second. Now we've got the phone lines are ablaze here. I'll tell you what I'm going to do because I'm not sure if Mike's back with us or not. Mike, are you here?
I am back, yes, and that seemed to solve the problem.
Mike is back. Could you not hear me? Was that the deal?
I'm sorry?
Could you not hear me? Was that the deal?
I could not hear you. That was the problem, and I thought it might be on my end. So
we're going to take a risk now. Because
I rebooted.
We're going to take a risk because you weren't here to help me handle the phone lines. All the mics are live. Tell me who's in the audience, or tell me who's in the studio. Who's, speak up. Speak up. Speak up, callers.
Hi, this is Terry Hampton.
Terry, how are you doing?
Hi.
And Keith's here, I believe. I believe I heard Keith's voice.
I had to go away, but now I've got, I couldn't hear a word you said, but I'm back online, so.
Well, maybe it was me then. Maybe it was me. If Keith couldn't hear me and Mike couldn't hear me. Terry, could you hear me?
I think it was the NSA trying to stifle your free speech.
Could you hear me ranting and raving, Terry?
I just walked in my house from the other event I was at, and I just called, so I didn't get to hear your rant.
I did do some ranting, but that's all right. If
you were fading out, Dave. You were just fading out, and it was, I don't know whether it was a storm or whether it was the phone lines, but we're back online anyway.
What I said was, and we're going to get on with the show. the Republicans are going to continue to lose until they learn gladiatorial combat. Every Republican who sets him or herself up as a candidate is going to be attacked, whatever their position, whatever their statement, whether they've ever approached the subject or not, because they stand on a indefensible platform. They stand and they continue to stand on this womb control that has become the love of the right. Now that's all right. I mean, if they want to stand on that, that's okay. I guess if they want to accept the consequences. But what I'm saying is that regardless of how adamant they've been about it, regardless of what they have had to say about it, they are going to be attacked and attacked and attacked and attacked by everyone on the left. You're standing on this platform. Well, I've never had anything to say about that. Well, I don't necessarily believe in that. You are standing on this platform that has this plank in it, and we're going to beat you down on it. Now, why doesn't the right, why doesn't every Republican candidate for any office anywhere see that happening and say to that opponent on the left, you are standing on this platform of global warming. It's indefensible. The science is showing you the fool every damn day. Every damn day, the science is showing you're a liar and continuing to advocate spending trillions of dollars on this thing. What is up with you? Why doesn't the right get down in the ring with the left and make that an issue? Anybody?
I have no answer to that question, Dave. I think Terry's probably hoping at least one Republican will lose. I have no answer to your question there. I just don't know. Terry,
okay.
Want to take it?
Terry,
I'm Terry Hampton. Thank you, Mike, for asking me involved this evening. I am the independent candidate that is on the ballot for the November general election. I'm running for the U.S. House of Representatives for Missouri's 8th District. So that is that's my brief introduction. I live in West Plains. I'm a native of Howe County. Actually, I live just south of West Plains and a native of Howe County and have lived in the district my entire life. Not a professional politician. I'm a citizen representative. So this is new to me in many ways, but by golly, I just said somebody's going to have to give it a shot, and I'm going to do it. I'm going to give it a shot. So,
all right.
You had to get a lot of signatures to get on the ballot. How many did you have to get?
Well, actually, the interesting thing and the reason that I decided to do it this time around is, you know, it's based on 2% of the people who voted in the last election, and typically that would be about 6,000 signatures. But the interesting thing is we had a special election last year, and hardly anybody showed up. So it's 2% based on those numbers, and I had to have 1,256 signatures, which actually turned out to be a lot, but certainly not 6,000. So I gathered... A few people gathered signatures for me, and then my husband and I visited all 30 counties in the district and got signatures from all of the counties, and I just got word just last week, in fact, that I had qualified, certified.
So do you have to have signatures? Do you have to have a representative sample of signatures from each county in the district?
I did not. I could have gotten them all from West Plains and Howe County if that's what I wanted to do, but... I just set it as my goal to go into the race saying that
I get support
from every county. So, no, that wasn't a requirement. That was just something that I put on myself to do.
So tell us before I get started, Terry, Terry Hampton. What do I call you, Ms. Hampton? Terry?
Call me Terry, please.
Terry. Okay.
She'd like you to say Congresswoman.
I'm sure she would, and someday maybe we will. So let's start off with your affiliation. The Independent Party is not a recognized party in the state, is it?
No, and actually I'm an independent, lowercase I independent. I am completely unaffiliated with the party in any way. And
okay.
So that puts, you know, a whole different twist on things, because I have there's no infrastructure, there's no support of any kind other than a true grassroots movement, you know, my volunteers and the people that are coming on board, and I'm gaining social media presence. And so I completely unaffiliated.
Okay. So how will your name appear on the ballot then? It won't be under Republican, and it won't be under Democrat. It won't be under Libertarian. Will it be under the title Independent?
You know, that's a good question. As far as I know, yes. That's how it's classified on the Secretary of State's website. So I believe
that is
the case.
When you say then, I have no affiliation, can't there be two people on the ballot under the title Independent?
Yes, that's exactly how the process works. There's no primary process for anyone who's running as an independent. So, for example, if three or four people had said, hey, this is the year I'm going to try this, I'm going to go get 1,256 signatures, if for everyone who would have gathered enough qualified signatures, we would have all been on the ballot in November.
Under the title Independent.
Independent, right.
Oh,
right.
Okay. So
yes.
Independent doesn't mean anything on the ballot except independent.
Independent,
okay.
Exactly.
All right. Now, start us off, Terry, then, by telling us why you're doing this. And I want to get really specific. You are saying there's a guy in this job who's not doing the job the way I approve, or I wouldn't be running to fire him. What's up with Jake Schmidt, first of all?
Well, let me go back even a little further than that. I have had in my mind, you know, I've been like many friends of mine and many people that we all know, you know, we've been saying for a number of years, somebody really needs to do something about the situation that we have in Washington. And in my mind, somebody with more resources and more time would be the one to step forward and do that. But it wasn't happening. And I have always had, perhaps in the back of my mind, that I would run for office at some point in my life. I think I thought the State House before I would try the U.S. House. But so I had in my mind, you know, all of these things going on. And then when Joe Emerson got reelected for her gazillionth term in 2012 and resigned practically the next day, that was such an infuriating thing to me, such a outrageous just slap in the face to District 8 and to the whole Democratic process. I thought, I don't even really care at this point who might be elected after that. That was when I decided I'm going to run. I'm going to put a real effort into this and run. And then as that whole process developed, and you all may remember how the special election worked, it was just bizarro world. I mean, you know, there was no primary process there. It was basically 100 committee members on both sides, for the Democrats and the Republicans. And, of course, the Constitution Party and the Libertarian, you know, they put forth candidates too. But the Republicans, less than 100 people, chose Jason Smith to be in the special election. Less than 100 Democrats chose Steve Hodge to be in the election. So there was that strange process. Those were the people who are in the special election. And, you know, that's how we ended up with Jason Smith. And So that was just a further frustration to me and the whole, as all of this has been building over the years, that was kind of the final straw. And then, and now that we have Jason Smith, there's so many things. And I'm really trying not to make this about him. I am really making this about the process, because citizen representatives, that's what we were always supposed to have. We were never supposed to have professional politicians, certainly not career politicians. And I just see Jason Smith as one more professional politician. There's no other way to say it. We're just breeding a whole one generation after another of attorneys, for the most part, who end up serving in the U.S. House of Representatives. And that's not a representation of the citizenry. That is not us being represented. So that's a little bit of background.
Just as a caveat for the listeners, I want to say, to repeat something that I've said here several times in the past, just so people know that I'm still keeping up with this. Less than 15% of the people in the U.S. Senate and the U.S. House of Representatives are, in fact, attorneys. Okay, Terry. Now,
But I'll intercede here. But Jason Smith is an attorney.
Yes, Jason Smith
and, is an attorney. Right.
I'm sorry, Terry. Go ahead, Terry.
That is the prime example of, you know, and is it really 15% House?
It's a little less than 15% of both the House and the Senate. The majority of people in the House and the Senate, in fact, have never been graduated with political science degrees and have never been in anything but politics. Yes, Jason is, in fact, an attorney.
I don't know if he ever practiced, though. That's been my burning question. Did he ever practice as an attorney? I'm just curious.
I can answer that. Jason went straight from college to law school, from law school to a special election to become a state representative, a similar situation to what got him into Congress.
Right.
Okay. And after being term limited out, fell into the situation that got him in Congress. So, despite claims of being raised as a farmer, Jason has never had a real job, at least since college, in his professional life.
Never had a hoe in his hand then.
Oh, well, I had a friend who shook his hand once at a political meeting and commented that his hands were too soft to be a farmer's hands. And another politician there said, well, Jason raises dogs. He's a dog farmer.
Yeah, I was going to say, dog farming, I guess, in some way. Yeah.
Oh, okay.
But, you know,
he's
always claimed, too, that his father was a mechanic, which is certainly an honorable profession, but that's not the same as being a farmer, so.
Okay, so, Terry, now we've established that that we're not going to make this about Jason, that it just is about citizen representation. Doug Enyard is certainly a citizen. Now, you're standing here saying, I'm a better choice than Doug Enyard. Tell us why.
Well, Dougie, I talked to him a few times. I work, this is no secret, I work for the West Plains Daily Quill. I am a staff writer there. I've worked there for the last couple of years. And so I had an opportunity to talk to Doug on the phone. And, you know, I think Doug is a great guy. I really do. And I think my concern is, while both the Libertarian Party and the Constitution Party are certainly not the same kind of party that the Democrats and the Republicans are, it's still a party affiliation. And I think that the Constitution Party is a party that has a real tough road in espousing the platform that it does.
Okay, I agree with you. I've always agreed with you. I've said 100 times, I like the Constitution Party. I like their liberty-mindedness. I like the people that I know in the Constitution Party.
Right.
But God help us all. God help us all if those people are ever in charge. I want two or three of them representing us in Washington D.C. But don't ever let him run the show. So basically, then you are saying I'm the best person for this job. Correct me if I'm wrong. Because I'm not tied to anyone. I'm not ideologically pigeonholed.
Yeah, yes? That's exactly it. No strings at all. And as I truly believe that and of course, you know, there's that survey that was released, I think, last year now, that 42% of the people in the United States identify as really independent of any party. And I think those numbers continue to climb, especially among the younger demographic. And certainly that was, as I went around the district, that really proved to be the case just on a practical level, with people saying, I am absolutely done with any kind of party. And there were so many people like myself that, you know, really don't identify with the platform or the ideals that any of the parties espouse. And I mean, I look at the Constitution Party and the Libertarians, the Republicans, the Democrats, you know, there's something from all of those parties that at some level appeals to me. But I'm not going to be tied to anything. I just can't be tied to anything.
Well, now let's don't go too far with that. I mean, I don't want you going to Washington D.C. Representing me if you don't have any feelings about anything. What is the function of government, Terry?
What is the function?
What is the function of the government?
Well, oh gosh, I should have looked up the list of questions that Campaign for Liberty folks always ask, and I ran out of time. Well, you know, I know for one thing,
I'm not comparing you to a dictionary. I'm not going to break out an encyclopedia and say, oh, you got this wrong. I want to hear what Terry Hampton believes is the purpose of a government, of our government. Go ahead.
Well, we have just gotten so far down the road of having any kind of purpose left. You know, we have just invented something that we all have bought into. You know,
right.
We have this path that we're going down that in my definition of government, it's local. You know, we should all be able to take care of ourselves, take care of our own communities, and stop relying on so much from above. You know, top down is never what I think it was envisioned to be in this country or any country that's going to be ultimately successful, because what we've done is we have continued to take power away from the people, and that is power away from local communities. And to me, when I talk about government, I would love to talk about local government. And
sure.
That's the definition of government. It's how we all get along every day.
Is this Mike Live, Dave?
Do what, Mike? Or Keith?
This is Keith. Is this Mike Live?
Yes.
I just want to... You asked Terry the question, and she still has to answer it, and it's the same answer whether you're talking about local government or state or federal. The answer is the same, and you had the right question. The question is, where do you go to find the answer, Terry?
Where do you go to find the answer? Well, it lies within the people. I mean, the people were always the ones who were supposed to have the power, and that's what's happened. We have a plutocracy now. We have government by an elite few, and that's never going to be successful for the citizenry,
Terry,
in the long run.
Well, Terry, okay, the answer Keith was wanting was the Constitution, just to shorten it all up.
Yes.
Governments are instituted among men for one reason and one reason alone. And when we go back to the source and we see what they wrote, they created a government that's so different than anything before or since. And it's based on that principle. You're right, the people are the final say on that. But basically, everybody's going to have their own opinion. You got to have a standard. They made a standard, and they said there's a reason why governments are instituted among men. And why is that?
Oh.
I'm sorry. I don't know what answer you're looking for.
He's actually looking for the Declaration of Independence now.
There's only one reason
I have,
the government for institutions.
I know that you resist being called a conservative or a liberal, but I have always found that finding out how a person thinks on some issues gives me an idea of how their mind works and whether or not I would trust them to represent me in a state or federal office. So if we were to take a few issues, let me see. Gun control, actually the Second Amendment is a very popular issue in our area. What is your feeling on the Second Amendment?
Well, you know, it is established in the Bill of Rights that we certainly have the right to keep and bear arms, and I have no reason that we should change what we have now. I mean, I know that there are many people who think that certain restrictions are going to change the situation where, you know, we've had horrible things happen, but horrible things have always happened throughout our history. And I wish, you know, there's a part of me that says, okay, if we just took all the guns away, we would solve all the problems. But we know at this juncture in time, or at any point in time, that's never been the case. So, you know, if I truly represent this district to start with, you know, I'm going to have to be a supporter of the Second Amendment, but I am anyway. So.
Okay.
Well, that brings up.
You're talking about local control being better. And we talked about Common Core and education standards last week, and a lot of the folks on with us last week would like to see the Department of Education done away with on the federal level and schools controlled locally. Do you have thoughts on that?
Well, what we've created with the Department of Education is just one more big function of government that has as its main purpose just to keep itself going. You know, it's just unsustainable, like so many other
areas of government.
And so,
does the federal government have any business being involved in education?
Well,
or not?
I don't think it does. Realistically, I don't think the Department of Education is going to go away anytime soon. But I would love to see. There's no reason for it. There's no good reason for it. All the reasons for it are bad. And I have a lot of friends and, you know, who are administrators and work in education. And, you know, even most of them say, one local administrator said he doesn't believe that the Department of Education is constitutional. So it's just a big money drain. It's just one more big money drain, you know. It's just feeding itself instead of, and then handing out dictates in addition to all of that. So a lot of my approach to a lot of those things is, you know, why are we funding them? How are they paying for themselves, and why? Why are they even there? So, and I don't want to misrepresent myself and say that I'm going to go there and start trying to do away with every department at the federal level. I mean, it's not my goal. Well, because I think it's an unrealistic goal. I really think, you know, people think that I'm not serious or that I'm naive, but I will tell you, all of these issues that we talk about, they really come down to corruption in government. And so my main, I mean, I'm just being realistic. I think that I need to go with one focus, and it is to address corruption and campaign finance reform and all the issues that are associated with that. It's the only, it's the one thing that I think we have to tackle before anything else changes. Because, you know, am I realistically going to go and say, all right, we're doing away with the Department of Education? Very few people in the House of Representatives are going to take me seriously if I say that. So I think we have to start at where we have to start at the start. And that is to regain control. The citizenry has to regain control. And as long as we have these outrageous decisions like Citizens United, and as long as people can go from Congress to the world of lobbying with such ease, you know, those are the things we're going to have to address. Because anything, any issue, I think you can pick any issue and tie it back to the fact that 0.5% of this country is running the country. So that's why I'm just, people say I'm naive, and I tend to think that people who are very focused on, not that we shouldn't be focused on issues, as you said, you know, you need to know my opinions, I get it, but I don't think those issues, like doing away with the Department of Education and doing away with some of those other departments, those aren't realistic goals, at least not for now.
Well, back in 1776, we had some guys in Philadelphia who were told they were not being very realistic in taking on the largest empire in the world. I like the idea of tackling unrealistic goals. It might take a generation or two.
Well, but that's what I'm saying,
Keith,
but we got to start.
Keith is with a group called the Convention of States, and one of the things that Keith's organization is trying to do is get an Article 5 convention to propose certain constitutional amendments.
Right.
One of them is to do away with the 16th Amendment, the Income Tax Amendment.
Yeah.
Another is the 17th Amendment, which created direct election of senators. Go back to the way we did it until, the early 1900s, where they actually represented the interests of the states and were chosen by the state legislatures. And a lot of folks believe that those two changes would solve some of the other problems you mentioned with the Citizens United and the small percentage of people that are actually controlling the country. And one of the problems I have with campaign finance reform is I've yet to see anything proposed that was not a First Amendment violation, like McCain-Feingold. So, any thoughts on
I have a couple questions for Terry. I have a couple questions for Terry, if you've got a second,
okay.
Terry.
Sure.
You mentioned corruption, and I'm right with you. There seems to be two issues that you know, I'm not running for office. What I'm seeking to do, and Mike characterized it to a degree. I'm really not into the specific amendments. I think that a deliberating convention of the right people will ask the right questions and will get to the point on the right problems, and I think that it'll be I think the people on the far left or the far right are going to be disappointed because the bar is 38 state ratification hurdle, and so anything that happens is going to be needed, and it's going to be pretty well bipartisan, and it's going to be essential. And a couple things you mentioned corruption. How would you go about doing that? My suggestion is that we have term limits or term rotation to break the cycle of the career politician. What do you think about that in terms of, I mean, they're never going to approve it out of Washington. Washington will never fix itself. But if the people and the state specifically would propose and then ratify a term limit or term rotation, what do you think, Terry? Would that help the corruption question?
I used to never be a fan of term limits. It seems, you know, counterproductive in a way, but obviously the trust of the public has been betrayed, and that's certainly putting it mildly. And I think at this point, you know, term limits, term rotations, I think it's going to have to be part of any kind of package of, you know, reform.
Well, let me ask you another question. In six years, almost 90% of the federal budget will be consumed by interest on the national debt. Now, is that a problem that you're willing to go up there and fight for and fight against?
We're definitely going to have to. That has to be addressed. You know, I think it's always fascinating to me that people that say, oh, you know, we've always, however they're Shirley Temple, gee whiz, sort of, we've always had debt, or I don't know, but whenever we've reached this level of debt and, you know, we have historically low interest rates, which are not probably going to last forever, if they were anywhere approaching historically high interest rates or even, you know, interest rates of a few percentage
we're at the bottom.
Yeah.
I listened to Ben Carson say last weekend that if we paid $10 million a day on this debt, it would take 5,000 years to pay it off. Now, nobody really is considering that because we think of an economy that's moving and growing. We could do it, and we would be surprised at how quick we could get some results. But you know, the way I'd like you to think is, do you have anybody in your family that's about 4 years old, Terry?
I have a little two-year-old grandson, so.
Okay. Well, that two-year-old grandson is going to be 30 years old in 2038. So in their day, where we're at 20% of what we spend nationally for interest, we're looking at 40 or 60% of the total GDP for interest alone. So I guess, do you think, here's another question. I have a senior senator from Oklahoma who is leaving Washington, D.C. specifically because he says, now he's a senior senator, and he's getting, when this term is over, he's going to get on a plane and he's going to go home, even though he has 2 years left.
Nice.
You can read about it on the Hill. I'll send you thehill.com. Just Google Senator Tom Coburn, and he said he's going home to work on something else because Washington will never fix the two problems that you just say that you want to go to Washington to fix. So I guess what I'm saying is, and I'm saying this to Mike, and I know where Dave stands is, and the folks who are listening, we need to get all on the same team. Not that we don't need to send good people to Washington, but there's good people leaving Washington because it will never fix itself. They'll say they're for term limits. Yeah, they'll do what they did on the balanced budget amendment when Ronald Reagan was president. They will fail it with one vote.
Mm-hmm.
And they'll know, everybody will know who it is ahead of time, who the extra vote is that will fail it. They will never fix the problem from the inside out. And that's what George Mason said, and, you know, 2 days before the Constitutional Convention was over. They will never relinquish power. They will never arrest their own tyranny.
Right.
And so I'm just asking you, and I'm asking everybody that's listening, you know, to think about those two problems. You know, we have some folks that say, well, you know, nullification is the answer. Okay. I agree it's got a place, but nullify the national debt for me and nullify this corruption that you're talking about, and I'm all in. But we don't have a lot of time. We don't have the time.
Okay, Terry, this is Dave again. I want to try to get back to where I started, and that is the function of government. And I agree with you. I want to tell you right now that I agree 100% with you. The more local the government, the better the government. But you're not running for a city council position. You're not running for a state house position. You're running for a federal government position. I read on your website with interest that there are some things, you say, that the federal government has to do. I agree with you 100%. And there's no right or wrong answer to this. This is about where is Terry Hampton coming from, okay? So you say there that the federal government probably is the best resource for and you say specifically Social Security and Medicare, or Medicare, I believe you say. Tell me why that is a function of the federal government.
Well, I think, again, it's the system that we've evolved over the years that is just going to take a lot of de-evolving to ever get out of. It's not logical just to say Social Security ends today. I don't believe that that is a bad thing. And I don't know how a system like that could at this point, at this juncture in our history, be administered in a different way. I think that those are things that we can all start backing out of. But I think that we have such immediate problems that trying to say, okay, we're shutting down Social Security would just create more problems than it would ever solve. And
okay.
And as far as why it's a function of the federal government, it's, you know, I talk about local communities because, you know, let's look at the healthcare fiasco, if you will, for a moment. Medicare was not perfect, but, you know, I don't think any of us want to go back to the days of poor houses and of really extreme poverty that was a problem many years ago. And not that the federal government is the best way to solve that, but it's just going to take some different thought processes. It's going to take some different ideas, and the federal government needs to get out of the way. And I'm not saying I know how to do that, but I am saying that there are people who know how to address issues like health care, and they're not a bunch of politicians, and they're not a bunch of lobbyists and insurance companies who write inflation like they have been, like the Affordable Care Act.
Okay.
Those aren't the ways to address things. Our local communities can come up with ways that other, you know, there are other ways to think about this. There are doctors in my community that say if the federal government would get out of the way, they could take care of the health care needs of the people in this community. And so, you know, when I talk about strong communities, I think that's going to have to be the answer in the long run if the government just doesn't completely bankrupt everything in the meantime.
Okay.
And that's where we're headed.
Okay. So basically, Social Security and Medicare are functions of the federal government just because there are bigger issues to worry about right now than just these. We can slowly back out of these. Maybe the government doesn't need to be as involved in these as it is right now. We can slowly back out of these, but those aren't the major issues of the day. There are bigger issues to tackle. Tell me right now, you go to Washington, D.C., January of 2015. These are the three biggest issues to me. These are three bills I will champion when I get to Washington, D.C. to fight three major issues that we need to deal with. Go ahead.
Well, to me, it's going to be one piece of legislation, perhaps, that – and there's already one. It's called the Anti-Corruption Act, and it's not perhaps perfect, but it deals with an awful lot of these issues that we've been talking about. And it's, you know, it stops members of Congress, stops politicians from taking bribes. It limits super PACs, the contributions that they can make, and it would close the door between that revolving door between Congress and the world of lobbying, and it would limit lobbyist donations, and there's also an element of public financing of campaigns. So to me, I honestly, you know, I'm just one person, and I think that any politician who makes promises about what they're going to do is being unrealistic at best and just, just well,
I'm not
that
asking.
Otherwise.
I'm not asking you to make me a promise that you will solve the problem. I'm saying these are the issues that I will champion, win or lose.
Well, that's
win
that's
or lose.
It. That's the
path or fate. These are the issues that I will champion. Okay, the Anti-Corruption Act. You said
that's just a starting point, just because it's one that's already been hammered out. It's been declared constitutional, and there are, you know, perhaps other variations on a theme, but it's the only way I know how to start addressing anything, because everything is tied to massive money. It is. We know that. We're living in a plutocracy.
That's fine. I don't have any problem with you, nor any disagreement with that last statement of yours. It is currently a federal violation punishable by up to 15 years in prison for a congressman to accept a bribe. How does the Anti-Corruption Act improve on that?
Well, I mean, when I say bribe, I mean, it's legalized bribery, I guess is what you call it. But it prohibits members of Congress from receiving contributions from industries or that they regulate. And to me, that's bribery. If you're able to take, you know, and again, not making this about Jason Smith, but for example, he's taken $8,000 from Monsanto, and Monsanto is not even in the district. So there are certainly points in time that he might be voting on matters related to Monsanto. So that is the kind of thing that it would prohibit. So, you know, it's the legalized bribery that we're going to have to address. Why should I or anybody within a district ever take a contribution from outside the district? I mean, unless it's from an individual, you know, my cousin, my best friend from Texas, send me $100. I mean,
how about
why?
Me? I'm over here. I'm over here in Springfield, and I'm Missouri. I'm out of your district, and I believe in you. You don't want my money?
I would take money from individuals. I like to cap it off at $200. I mean, I would take more than that. But it's the industries that Congress regulates that are forking over the money, and we all know that. And that's where there's a true conflict of interest. Anybody has a right to,
so,
as an individual, certainly lobby their, you know, a representative to see their way, but I just don't want them to come with a check in hand.
Should no corporation or no business, no private business person, no small business owner be allowed to contribute to a political campaign?
Well, I think it should be as individuals.
Okay,
you know,
so
an individual is certainly free to do what they want. I just have, you know, I just
Bill,
have trouble
so
with corporations
Microsoft,
being identified as people.
Microsoft should not be able to send you $1 million, but Bill Gates should be. Is that about
it? He shouldn't be able to send me $1 million. He can send me $200. I would take that.
So all political contributions,
some reasonable limit. No,
all
political
contributions, regardless of source, should be limited to a specific amount.
I think it should be limited to a specific amount, and it should be very, very clear. Just on a congressman's website, you know, just list of where the contributions came from, and the dark money has got to go. There's just got to be transparency, and that's. It's all the same. I mean, I'm not saying that it's going to be solved, but that's where we're going to have to start.
I'm asking a question out of ignorance here. I don't know the answer. Are third party or independent candidates required to file with the Missouri Ethics Commission when they run for office?
No, not with the Missouri Ethics Commission, but with the Federal Election Commission, and which I've already done. I've taking care of all of that over the last few months, which is a real fascinating process, by the way.
Yes.
But and technically, until a candidate has raised or spent $5,000, you don't have to file with the FEC. They don't even consider you, you know, serious at all until you've reached that point. And I haven't. I just have a few $100 that people have sent me so far. And when I reach that $5,000 point, though, that's when we'll file with the FEC. So bypasses the Missouri Ethics Commission, but, you know, at the federal level, it's the Federal Election Commission you're dealing with.
Okay, I have one last question for you, and then I'm going to turn it over to Keith and Mike to wrap it up. There are basically two philosophies of representative government. One is that I have these beliefs, and if you believe the same way I do, vote for me. I'm going to go to Washington, D.C., and I'm going to vote for what's best for you. That's a person who says, I'm going to vote my conscience. I believe that XYZ is wrong, so I'm going to always vote against XYZ. I believe that ABC is right, so I'm always going to vote for ABC. And then there's another philosophy that says, I represent the people of the 8th District. You communicate with me when I get to Washington, D.C. It doesn't matter if I believe in ABC. If my constituents believe in ABC, I'm going to vote what they want me to. And it doesn't matter if I don't believe in XYZ. If my constituents do, then that's the way I'm going to vote. Now, which of those schools do you belong to?
Well, you know, that's the dilemma, isn't it? I think that...
It's the question. But, I don't know that it's a dilemma for you, but it's certainly the question pending right now.
It is a dilemma for me, because I think what we're seeing a lot of is a lack of leadership, because I think there are sometimes, for whatever reason, that a representative would vote in a manner that perhaps he or she knows not the majority of his or her district, that's not what they want. I mean, I can envision that happening, but I also think that it's incumbent on me to represent the values of this district. And if I don't, I don't know why I would run in this district. So I just think that there are going forward, I think we all have to think about how we want to be governed. I think we need to decide, no, we're in a different day and age technologically. Do we have to send representatives to Washington? You know? Maybe each representative should have a centralized office within the district. And, you know, there's all kinds of ways to vote. I think now the only reason they go to Washington is just so they can spend 80% of their time fundraising. So I think that there are certainly different ways going forward that we might discuss in governing ourselves. And maybe there's even a way, you know, I would love to have conversations with people who are experts in things that I'm not. You know, I don't pretend to know a lot about a lot of things. I just am really passionate about returning representation to the citizenry. And I just think that there would be committees or coalitions or whatever you want to call them, I can envision them in each county. And, you know, people that want to be involved in government, you know, I'm really tired of people who say, oh, I don't want to have anything to do with politics. And it's like, well, you're the problem. If you don't want to have anything to do with politics, you're the problem. But people who want to have input, they're serious about it, you know, get together in committees and find a way to really express the values of this district and to really come up with, you know, we haven't had a fresh idea in Washington in decades, I don't think. It's just the same old stuff getting rehashed all the time. And there's got to be a better way to do it than we're doing it now. And so,
Terry, I have a question for you.
Sure.
What you just described in many ways is exactly the kind of government that our framers had in mind. And the difference between what you're describing and what we have today is what you're describing is a government by people who are close to you, who are doing, you know, where the power is close to you, as opposed to the power being in Washington, D.C. The difference is between the Constitution as it was written and the Constitution as it's being followed right now. And I guess what we talked about a few minutes ago, what my aim is to make the federal government go back to doing the roughly 9 to 17 things, depending who you ask, that they're supposed to do. A good example of when we have an election like we just had in Missouri, where we don't have any national election, but we have state senators and state representatives running, but nothing on, no presidential election. What happened? 25% of the people showed up to vote, but if you have a presidential election, you know, 60 or 60+%. It's exactly backwards. What we need to have is a system in which 75% show up to vote when your local state representatives and senators are running, and then when the presidential election's happening, as well as, you know, the Congress, nobody gives a rip because they're irrelevant. They're not. They don't have much to do because the government, as designed by the Constitution as it was written, doesn't have much to do. We'll let the president take care of the national monuments and things like that. He can, you know, but there's some, what you call, you know, there's enumerated powers. And we have two constitutions. We have one today that's being followed as being interpreted, in which the federal government, in a collusion with the courts and the Congress, can do anything, and they can tax any amount that they want. There's no limit. They've already said there's no limit.
Right.
And they're proceeding to use what I call a giant replicator machine and make people think that they can continue to just turn out cell phones and food stamps and you name it. There's no end, and they've made many of them made society basically a society that's dependent on the federal government. What you described is a government for the people who are actually governing within a state are the people you know where your state representative's house is, you know how to get there, you can drive to his house, and you can go to his office if you need
right.
to, and you can get an appointment. Now, that is the government that you're describing is the constitutional government that our framers meant for us to have.
Well, and, you know, I think intuitively people who are thinking independently know that there's a better way of doing things. You know, you guys know just by talking to me, I'm not a constitutional expert, and I don't pretend to be, but, you know, I am studying the Constitution as much as I can in addition to running for office, and it's pretty obvious that we are really far away from what the intent was supposed to be, and we haven't formed a very perfect union in the process, and we sure don't have domestic tranquility. So, you know, we've just gotten so far away from what it was ever meant to be, and that's, you know, I talk about professional politicians, and that's just what we're breeding. You know, we're just breeding professional politicians who have no regard for anything other than just creating a machine that's its only purpose is to feed itself. And that's just not sustainable, you know. I don't know how we've sustained it this long. And I don't know who said it earlier, but, you know, time is running out. If we don't do something about it soon, then I don't know what the end result's going to be, but I think it's going to be a lot. I think
Terry,
hello?
Are you there?
Yes, I am.
Okay, we had a little technical glitch, and actually our time is running out in just a moment, so I'm going to thank you very much. And would you come back with us again before the election?
You know, I will. I love being challenged. You know, you guys, obviously, I appreciate how much time you've put into studying a lot of topics that I have not studied, and I appreciate that. And You know, I'm not trying to say I'm a perfect candidate for what you guys have in mind, but I just want to be somebody that, like, keeps pecking away at the dam until it finally bursts. You know what I'm saying? And, yeah.
Well, I'll get a hold of you and we'll get you back on.
It's been really great visiting with you guys. And, yeah, I'll come back. I'm not scared.
Great. Thank you much. You take care.
Okay. Thank you, guys.
Okay. And, Keith, thank you also for coming. And, Dave, time is running out. Everybody have a great week, and we'll be back tomorrow night talking about transparency in voting and paper ballots. Thanks.
Goodbye.
There are so many contradictions in all these messages we send. Keep asking, how do I get out of here? Where do I fit?